Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers.
I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
Welcome to The Deep Dive, the place where we sift through the sources, pull out the crucial insights, and hopefully give you that definitive, nuanced understanding of the people, places, and ideas shaping our world.
And today, we're really diving deep into an actor whose voice, well, they're instantly recognizable, aren't they? Often tied to this particular brand of theatrical chaos, maybe eccentric genius. We're talking about Richard E. Grant.
That's right.
But the man behind that persona is, you know, the one whose career just exploded playing this perpetually drunk aristocrat.
Yeah.
He's actually, well, a really complex tapestry. It's woven from dual identity, profound personal rigor, and some career-defining irony.
Absolutely. And we've pulled together a pretty comprehensive stack of biographical sources for this. We're charting the whole remarkable journey of Richard Grant Esterhazy. Yes, that was his birth name. So our mission, really, in this deep dive is to get past just the famous roles. We want to uncover the specific cultural influences, the almost unbelievable personal paradoxes, and those defining career moments that explain the extraordinary depth and, frankly, the breadth of his work.
Yeah, it's like a study in how an artist can synthesize these wildly different worlds,
yeah.
You know, from colonial Africa, Swaziland specifically, all the way to Hollywood, and forge them into this unique, really enduring career.
Think of this as your essential shortcut, maybe, to understanding how someone can spend their childhood steeped in the history of, well, a British protectorate in southern Africa,
right,
yet become one of the UK's most valued character actors. Someone who can just slide seamlessly between, say, an Oscar-nominated performance and, I don't know, a Marvel villain.
Exactly. We promise those aha moments, the kind that might fundamentally shift how you view his filmography. You know.
Okay, so let's unpack this. And I think we have to start right where his life began, because his origin story, it's just foundational to who he is, to his identity.
Absolutely. He was born Richard Grant Esterhazy, May 5th, 1957, in Mbabane. Now, back then, it was known as the Protectorate of Swaziland.
Right, which today is the independent kingdom of Eswatini. He's, what, 68 years old now?
That's right, 68. And that birthplace, Mbabane, it immediately places him geographically kind of outside the standard mold for a British performer of his generation, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
And the complexity of his background, you see it reflected in his heritage, too. He holds dual citizenship, Swazi and British.
Which is fascinating in itself.
It is. And his ancestry is this mixture. English, Dutch Afrikaner, and German. But what's really interesting here is that despite this European lineage, his formative years were entirely African.
And he speaks the language fluently.
He's fluent in Siswati, yeah, the national language. That immersion is key.
That multilingual ability, that cultural immersion, it's critical, like you said. And his family, they were pretty central to the colonial structure he grew up in, weren't they?
Yes. His father, Henrik Esterhazy, wasn't just living there. He was the head of education for the British government administration in Swaziland.
Wow, okay.
So that placed Grant in a very specific sociopolitical bubble, you know, during a time of really intense cultural transition in that region.
It creates this this fascinating duality, doesn't it? He's living within the British administrative framework in Africa, absorbing English culture, language, sensibility, but through that very specific lens.
Exactly. He's even talked about his upbringing being, I think the quote is, mired in a 1960s sensibility.
Huh.
This isolation, this separation from the shifting trends back in the UK, it had a really peculiar result on his voice, which is, let's face it, one of his most distinctive professional tools.
Ah, okay. And this is where we get to that accent anomaly detail, right?
That's
which
right.
I think is one of those deep dive nuggets that explains so much about why he's cast in certain ways.
Precisely. The director, Charles Sturridge, who cast him, I think it was in Brideshead Revisited.
Oh, yeah.
He noted that Grant speaks English like someone from the 1950s.
Right. And it's not like an affectation, is it? It's not something he puts on.
Not at all. It's a kind of cultural preservation almost. The English spoken by those colonial administrators in Swaziland during his youth, with the period English of that era, but kind of frozen in time and distance.
So when he arrived in the UK, his natural accent just sounded decades older than people his own age.
Exactly. Which, ironically, makes him perfectly suited for playing, you know, eccentric aristocrats, stuffy but charming types, characters rooted in historical prestige dramas.
All those roles that need that very specific, slightly heightened, maybe slightly dated English sound?
He basically inherited the perfect theatrical voice for period British drama just by growing up thousands of miles away from Britain. It's quite something.
It's the ultimate example, really, of a cultural fingerprint becoming a professional advantage. But while he gained that professional edge, the connection to his roots, it seems like it remains intensely personal for him. Oh, absolutely. And nothing illustrates this physical connection to his past, and specifically to his late father, more poignantly than that detail about the two watches.
Yes, the dual watch detail. I read that. The sources say he used to wear a watch on each wrist.
That's right. One of them was set to Swaziland time, and it had been given to him by his father when he was dying.
Wow.
Just think about the weight of that symbolism for a moment. He's literally carrying the time of his origin, right? The memory of his father, the clock of his childhood home, side by side with the time zone of his professional life in the UK or wherever he was filming.
It's such a powerful image. A man always anchored, in a way, to a moment and a place that he actually had to leave to pursue his career. It speaks volumes, I think, about grief and the enduring importance of that foundational identity.
Absolutely. It's a visual metaphor for maybe what a lot of expatriate artists feel. But to build that global career, he knew he had to make a critical sort of strategic adjustment to his identity.
Okay, so this brings us to his education and that formal name change. Yeah. After attending local schools, St. Mark's, and then the independent Waterford Cum Laude United World College near Mbabane.
Which is quite a well-known school, actually.
It is, yes. He moved to South Africa in May 1976. He went to the University of Cape Town, studied English and drama, and he worked with the Space Theater Company there.
And then the move to Britain.
That came in 1982. It was about a year after his father's death, actually. And this is the moment when Richard Grant Esterhuizen formally becomes Richard E. Grant.
And the E is for Esterhuizen, right? He kept the initial.
He did. But the intention behind this change, it's explicit. And it's really crucial to understanding how he defined himself professionally. When he registered with Equity, the actors' union, he adopted the name Richard E. Grant specifically to truncate his, quote, African-sounding surname, Esterhuizen, down to just that initial E.
So it wasn't just about making it shorter or easier to say. It was a deliberate calculation, wasn't it? A kind of political and professional move to simplify a surname that was complex, multi-layered, and potentially well-loaded at the time.
Precisely. Think about the context. British theater and film in the 1980s, carrying an African-sounding surname, even though he's from Swaziland, not South Africa, could instantly pigeonhole him.
Or force him to constantly navigate political associations linked to apartheid-era South Africa.
Exactly. By reducing it to just a single initial E, he kept a nod to his heritage, yes, but he created this clean, adaptable professional identity. It allowed his talent and that distinctive 1950s English accent to define him rather than his complex surname.
It was an intentional act of streamlining, wasn't it? Just clearing the path to maximize his professional opportunity.
Absolutely. Very deliberate.
Okay, so moving from those complex, carefully curated origins to his actual career breakthrough, we arrive at what has to be the central paradox of his entire professional life, the character of Withnail.
Oh, Withnail. Richard E. Grant's very first film role, the perpetually spectacularly inebriated title character in the 1987 black comedy Withnail and I.
And it achieved cult classic status almost instantly, didn't it? For so many people, it's the role they think of first when they hear his name, even after decades of other high-profile work.
Absolutely. It's defining. And that debut role, it just launched his career. Almost immediately, it led to subsequent supporting parts in pretty major films like Henry and June, L.A. Story, The Player.
He was suddenly everywhere.
It really was. And speaking of L.A. Story, which he filmed in the early 90s, the sources have this wonderfully eccentric little anecdote. It perfectly captures the contrast, I think, between the sort of chaos of Withnail and the intellectual rigor of the actual Richard E. Grant.
Oh, you have to tell us. Is this the facts thing?
It is. The Facts Exchange with Steve Martin.
It's brilliant. Who communicates solely by facts in the 90s?
Apparently they did.
Yeah.
While they were filming, Grant and Steve Martin communicated almost entirely by exchanging these facts notes, just stream of consciousness thoughts, witty observations, intellectual humor. And Martin was so delighted by Grant's writing, by his mind, that he meticulously kept the entire stack of faxes. Apparently, it grew to be over 2 inches thick.
No way.
Yeah, and Martin described them, get this, as valuable aesthetic chunks from a screeching mind.
Valuable aesthetic chunks from a screeching mind. That's fantastic.
Isn't it?
And that detail, it's critical, like you said. It shows that the man who plays this chaotic, self-destructive mess of Withnail is, in reality, this disciplined writer capable of generating these aesthetic chunks of wit that someone as sharp as Steve Martin really values.
Exactly. But the paradox, it just gets deeper when you consider the actual foundation of the Withnail performance itself, that chronic staggering drunkenness.
Right, because here is the key aha moment, the one that really defines his commitment to his craft, I think.
It's the absolute core of the irony. The crucial fact is, Richard E. Grant completely abstains from drinking alcohol. Mm. He doesn't drink at all.
Because he has an actual physical intolerance to it, right? His body literally cannot process alcohol. He gets sick immediately.
That's it. That is the astonishing irony. The actor who became globally famous for embodying arguably the most cynical, desperate, and dedicated alcoholic in modern cinema is physically incapable of safely consuming alcohol himself.
He built his entire career, initially at least, on a performance representing the very thing his body rejects. It's mind-blowing.
It really is.
But, okay, the big question then is, how does an actor play such convincing, all-consuming drunkenness if they have absolutely zero personal experience with it? This is where the director comes in, isn't it?
This is where the story gets, well, pretty intense.
Yeah.
And it definitely raises questions about commitment, the extremes of method acting, maybe even safety protocols back then.
Oh.
To ensure Grant could convincingly portray the sheer depth of Withnail's inebriation, the director, Bruce Robinson, issued what can only be called a professional mandate.
Okay.
He forced Grant, and forced seems to be the word used, to drink a bottle of champagne and half a bottle of vodka over the course of one night.
Oh my.
Essentially compelling him to experience profound drunkenness for the first and apparently only time in his life, just so he'd know what it felt like.
That sounds honestly traumatic for someone with a physical intolerance. Yet it was deemed necessary for the professional outcome, for the performance.
It's an extraordinary level of professional commitment, however you look at it. He had to overcome a genuine physical boundary, a personal aversion, for the sake of the craft.
It wasn't just watching drunk people. It was forced immersion into a state of physical distress.
Precisely. All to capture the truth of the character. That experience, apparently as horrible as it was, must have provided the foundational sensory memory he needed to absolutely nail that performance.
And launch his entire career off the back of it.
Exactly. And crucially, once he had that sensory memory, he never needed to repeat it. The performance became this incredible feat of disciplined recall and technique.
Which contrasts utterly with the hedonistic, out-of-control image he projected on screen.
Absolutely. The success of Withnail and I isn't just about the brilliant writing. It's about a disciplined, sober actor achieving a level of realism in portraying addiction that, frankly, fooled an entire generation of viewers, didn't it?
It absolutely did.
That contrast, the chaotic persona on screen versus the personal rigor required to create it, that really defines the foundation of his work, I think. That ability to embody something fundamentally outside, maybe even repugnant to, his own personal life. And that intense foundation, playing Withnail, it established him not just as this cult figure, but as a supremely adaptable character actor.
Yeah.
You know, for decades, he was often the eccentric scene stealer, known for that theatrical flair.
Right, he was brilliant in supporting roles, but maybe not always seen as the prestige lead.
Exactly. He was recognized largely for that supporting work. But then came, well, let's call it the 2018 Renaissance.
Ah, yes. His peak critical recognition, real validation, arrived with his role as Jack Hawk in Mariel Heller's drama, Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Oh.
Opposite Melissa McCarthy.
That's the one. And that role, Jack Hawk, it allowed him to shed some of that manic energy he was maybe famous for and inhabit this character defined by profound vulnerability and loneliness. It was quite a shift.
It felt like a real career pivot, didn't it? Cementing him not just as a cult favorite, but as a major prestige actor capable of sweeping the entire awards circuit.
Totally. It proved he could pivot from that kind of farce and the Withnail energy to deeply nuanced melancholic drama about things like loneliness and codependency.
And the award's attention for that single performance was just staggering, wasn't it?
It really was. Nominations for Best Supporting Actor at the Academy Awards.
The BAFTAs.
The Golden Globes.
Screen Actors Guild Awards.
Pretty much all the big ones.
And he won quite a few, too.
Oh, yeah. He secured wins from major critical bodies, like the Independent Spirit Award for Best Supporting Male.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
The New York Film Critics Circle Award, several others too. It felt like this huge validation of his entire trajectory.
It showed that the actor famous for maybe the largest, loudest performance of his early career, Withnail, could achieve equal or maybe even greater success playing this quiet, broken man.
That shift required incredible control, didn't it? Which links right back to that discipline core we were talking about earlier, the guy who could play drunk while being sober.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we look at the entire arc of his career, what really stands out is just his remarkable versatility across different universes, genres, budgets. He seems to move effortlessly from deeply personal drama to the absolute biggest blockbuster franchises imaginable.
He truly is a professional chameleon. You see his commitment to the modern franchise landscape across multiple major IPs, right?
Definitely.
In fantasy and sci-fi, you've got him as a Legion General Enric Pride in Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker.
Right, in the final film of that trilogy.
And he played the villainous corporate scientist Xander Rice in the superhero film Logan, which was critically acclaimed.
General Pride, actually, thinking about it, is a perfect use of his specific talent, isn't it? He brings that refined, slightly old-school villainy to the First Order.
Mm-hmm.
It injects the specific mannered gravitas that elevates what could have just been a standard corporate bad guy.
Exactly. He makes the villain feel like a specific type of person, not just a plot device.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the younger generation probably knows him best from his unforgettable turn in the MCU.
Classic Loki. Yes. An older, delightfully flamboyant variant of the trickster god in the Disney Plus series, Loki.
He was brilliant in that.
He brought so much pathos and comedy, too, to a character who was essentially a walking Easter egg for longtime comic fans. He made him feel completely real.
And the ability to shift from the, you know, the stern gravitas of a Star Wars general to the tragic comic camp of classic Loki, it just demonstrates a complete absence of ego, doesn't it, about the type of role he takes on. If the material seems interesting, he just commits fully.
Yeah, you get that sense. And his portfolio of prestige historical dramas is equally impressive, spanning his whole career, really. Dr. Jack Seward in Coppola's Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Larry Lefferts in Scorsese's The Age of Innocence.
George in Robert Altman's Gosford Park.
Michael Heseltine in The Iron Lady. The list goes on.
And he hasn't slowed down recently either. He played the emotionally distant patriarch Sir James in Saltburn.
Right, just last year.
And the incredibly vain Sir Walter Elliot in the recent adaptation of Persuasion.
He really understands how to use that distinct vocal style, those physical mannerisms, to immediately signal things like social status or vanity or emotional distance. It's shorthand, but brilliant shorthand.
But I think the most complicated and maybe the most reflective segment of his career versatility has to be his extremely fluid relationship with one specific British institution, Doctor Who.
Oh, yes. His history with the Doctor. It's less a timeline and more like a multiverse of identity, isn't it?
It's a great way to put it.
It really is kind of a metaphor for his entire career, constantly adapting his role and relationship to a central idea. His appearances span, I think, four distinct levels of canon and genre within that single franchise.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredibly rare for any actor.
Okay, so break it down for us. Where did the Doctor Who journey begin for him?
Well, it started relatively simply back in 1999. There was a non-continuity comedy sketch for Red Nose Day called Doctor Who and the Curse of Fatal Death.
The one written by Stephen Moffat, right, with Rowan Atkinson and Hugh Grant as doctors too.
That's the one. Richard E. Grant played the quite handsome doctor in that. It was just a joke, you know, lighthearted bit of fun.
Okay, simple enough. But then things got complicated.
They did. Fast forward to 2003, he voiced the Schalke Doctor in an official animated webcast called Scream of the Schalke.
Right, I remember hearing about this.
Now, what's absolutely critical about the Schalke Doctor is that this version was fully intended by the BBC at the time to be the official Ninth Doctor. The canonical regeneration meant to usher in the series' revival.
Before they changed their minds and decided to go with the live-action TV series with Christopher Eccleston instead.
Exactly. So, for a brief, official moment in time, Richard E. Grant was the Ninth Doctor, a canonical placeholder, if you like.
Wow, a canonical almost Doctor, that's wild.
It is. But then, okay, the series gets successfully rebooted on TV, mm-hmm. and then he finally enters the official TV continuity in 2012-2013. But not as a hero.
No, he came back as a villain, right.
A major antagonist. He played Dr. Walter Simeon, whose body was ultimately taken over by the classic villain, the Great Intelligence. He was central to episodes like The Snowman and The Name of the Doctor during Matt Smith's era.
So let me get this straight. He played the joke doctor, the almost canonical doctor, and then a major official villain all within about a decade and a half.
You got it. And just to perfectly close the loop on his adaptability within this one franchise, he returns again very recently in 2024's episode Rogue, appearing in an uncredited cameo, basically as a visual projection, a memory of the Doctor's previous incarnations. This willingness to constantly return to the source material in such different forms as a joke, a placeholder, a monster, a memory, it just perfectly demonstrates his nonlinear, adaptable nature as an artist, doesn't it?
Okay, so moving beyond his performances, brilliant as they are, Grant has also sought to kind of control the narrative of his own life, not just by acting in stories, but by actually writing and directing his own story.
Yeah, and in doing so, he returned directly to the source of his identity, Swaziland.
Which takes us to his 2005 film, Wawa.
That's right. His directorial and writing debut. It's a semi-autobiographical film, loosely based on his complex childhood experiences growing up in Swaziland around the time of its independence. Nicholas Hoult plays the young Grant figure.
And it was a real passion project, wasn't it? It took him ages to get it made.
It was. Deeply personal. He apparently spent over 7 years trying to realize it.
And the idea to write it came from?
The impetus for that shift, from acting to writing his own story, came directly from his earlier work, funnily enough. A screenwriter apparently first recommended he try his hand at a script after reading Grant's memoir about the making of With Nail.
Ah, With Nails. The Film Diaries of Richard E. Grant from 1996.
That's the one. So it's this wonderful synergy, isn't it? The documented chaos of his professional debut ultimately led him to document the deep complexity of his personal origin story.
But from what I've read, the making of Wawa itself was apparently just as chaotic, if not more so, than anything in his fictional films.
Oh, the stories are legendary. The sources revealed the production was absolutely fraught with dramatic tension, much of which, again, he documented with pretty ruthless honesty in his subsequent book, The Wawa Diaries, which came out in 2006.
And that book got a lot of praise specifically for its candor, right? Because he didn't hold back.
Not at all. He was extremely vocal about the difficulties, particularly his, let's say, disastrous and difficult working relationship with the producer. Marie Castile mentioned Char, who he felt was inexperienced.
How did he describe her?
He candidly called her a control freak out of control and apparently vowed never to see her again.
Wow. That is brutal honesty, especially in an industry where, you know, diplomacy is usually key. What were the actual problems? What led to such a bad relationship?
Well, according to Grant's account, they were significant, practical, infrastructural problems tied directly to the production logistics. And they went right to the heart of the film's ability to even exist.
That what?
Firstly, the producer apparently failed to obtain the necessary song rights and clearance for the soundtrack, which is a huge deal for a period film.
Yeah, massive.
Secondly, and perhaps even more absurdly, she failed to secure clearance to actually film in Swaziland, the central setting of his own autobiographical movie.
Wait, so the director, who grew up there making a film about his childhood there, had to step away from directing to basically solve a massive bureaucracy problem caused by his producer, which threatened the entire shoot.
Exactly. The situation was apparently so dire that it forced Grant to personally arrange a meeting with the King of Eswatini, King Naswati III, to seek clemency and secure the necessary filming permissions himself.
That is incredible. Appealing directly to a monarch because of paperwork issues related to filming your own childhood memoir.
It highlights the immense personal effort he had to put in just to safeguard his most personal artistic project from what he saw as corporate mismanagement. It's quite a story.
And that candidness about the difficulties, the bad management, the long struggle, it seems like it's just part of his writing DNA, doesn't it?
It really is. And that same commitment to honesty, but now focused on something far more profound like grief, defines his more recent writing. In 2022, he released the memoir, A Pocket Full of Happiness.
Right, which was written
mostly during the last year of his wife's life. Documenting their final intimate months together, it's incredibly moving.
Yeah. Let's transition to his personal life then, because unlike the on-screen chaos he sometimes portrays, it seems defined by stability and devotion, particularly his marriage.
Absolutely. He was married to the voice coach Joan Washington from 1986 right up until her death in September 2021.
That's a 35-year partnership, almost unheard of in show business.
It really is. And Joan Washington, she wasn't just a stabilizing force in his life. She was a highly respected voice coach in the industry in her own right. Her passing in 2021 after being diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer was clearly devastating for him.
And his subsequent writing, like A Pocket Full of Happiness, really reflects that enduring love and loss.
Deeply. They had two daughters together as well.
And beyond his family life, he has a few other notable interests that kind of ground him, showing a wider range of passions, right?
Yeah, a few interesting ones. He's on record as being an atheist. He's an avid supporter of the Premier League football club West Ham United.
Ah, a fellow Hammer.
Apparently so. And perhaps slightly surprisingly, he's a devoted lifelong fan of Barbra Streisand.
Really? Barbra Streisand, that's great.
Isn't it? The fandom is real. He's apparently gone so far as to conduct his own personal tour of her early New York landmarks.
That's amazing. It shows that beneath the, you know, the highly mannered actor, there's this enthusiastic, almost zealous fan, just like the rest of us. It's quite humanizing, isn't it?
Totally. A great counterpoint to the sometimes austere, dramatic persona.
And professionally, he's also diversified his creativity into, well, a completely different world of luxury goods.
Yes, the perfume. In 2014, he launched his own unisex perfume brand called Jaisha. It debuted exclusively at Liberty of Regent Street in London.
And this venture seems like quite an interesting extension of his artistic persona, doesn't it? Focusing on scent and memory. It feels like a very sensory, almost artistic endeavor in itself.
It does. He talks about linking scents to specific memories and places.
And what's really special about that business model, I think, is the family collaboration involved.
Yeah, he runs the business in collaboration with his daughter, Olivia, which again ties his artistic and entrepreneurial sides directly back into his personal life. It echoes that theme we saw with his dedication to his wife, his documentation of his father's memory.
It feels like he's managed to parlay his distinctive public profile and his personal aesthetic into this tangible, collaborative family business.
Exactly. Another layer to the man.
So if we kind of step back and look at the whole architecture of identity that Richard E. Grant has built over his life and career, it really is a masterclass in strategic self-definition, isn't it?
It really is. He took Richard Grant Esterhazy, this dual citizen from Swaziland with complex colonial and European roots,
and strategically, consciously dropped that complicated surname, reducing it to just a single initial E, specifically to navigate the professional UK landscape more easily.
And then, almost immediately, he secures his place in cinematic history through just an unparalleled paradox.
Yeah.
A man who is physically intolerant of alcohol becomes globally famous playing one of the great cinematic drunks.
A performance achieved only through that single professionally mandated physical intervention. That discipline hidden beneath the chaotic facade, that feels like the real key to his longevity.
I think so too. And he sustained that career through sheer unmatchable versatility, didn't he?
Yeah.
Moving from the most nuanced, emotionally broken performance like Jack Hawk, which finally gets him that Oscar nomination,
all the way to portraying classic Loki with utter glee, or a Star Wars general, or multiple contradictory versions of the Doctor. He seems fearless in his choices.
His story really shows us, I think, that an artist's most authentic self often resides in the surprising paradoxes they carry within them.
Yeah. He is the disciplined, sober, British African gentleman, expertly playing the role of the chaotic, drunken English ne'er-do-well.
And he clings so tightly to the physical markers of his past, that Swazi-inflected accent, the memoirs about his childhood, the memory symbolized by that second watch ticking on Swaziland time.
Even as his entire professional success depends on adapting and adopting completely new identities, role after role.
Exactly. Which brings us, I suppose, to the final provocative thought for you, our listener, to consider long after this deep dive is complete.
Okay, let's hear it.
Given Grant's intentional truncation of his family name, that deliberate shedding of Esterhuizen, but also his persistent physical link to Swaziland via that timepiece, what is the true fixed home for an artist whose entire success relies on adapting and adopting new personas?
Where does the real self reside?
And maybe think about this for yourself. What specific elements of our own past do we choose to strategically truncate or maybe just downplay? And what personal time, what memories or origins do we continue to physically carry forward, maybe like a second watch, as we attempt to define our modern selves in a constantly changing world?
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers. Watch it work.